Yes, lots of conceptual overlap with the gospel, which is Matthew 9, starting at 35, and running into chapter 10. So we'll turn over there, especially what Dr. Lessing said before, that the people's identity and mission flows out of what Yahweh has done. And so you start with Jesus being compassionate, and then all of a sudden compassionate people get sent. So there's lots and lots of overlap. I think the appointed lesson starts at 9:35 and runs through 10:08, and then in parenthetically takes us almost to the middle of the chapter. That's an awful lot to preach on. And there is actually even a major conceptual shift in chapter 10. So for instance, initially the 12 are sent out more or less as shepherds, under shepherd, right? Because Jesus, the people, says they're like sheep without a shepherd, and he talks about the harvesting imagery, of course. But initially they're given authority to do amazing things and so forth. But then in 10:16, the metaphor actually sort of reverses, and he says, I'm sending you out as sheep among wolves. And so it's difficult to structure chapter 10, but one common way to do it, at least, is to see a major shift at verse 16. So as I was thinking about how you might, or how one might preach on this first half of chapter 10, it's at least two sermons. So I might encourage preachers to maybe not even take up the verses that are in parentheses in the Inspired Thrivent calendar, which is where I get the lessons from, but to just maybe stick with 9:35 through 10:08, and that would be a little bit more of a coherent, I think, unit to work from. So let's go back and work through the text then. Verse 35 is a kind of a summary statement. Matthew has three of these. One in 4 and one at the end of this discourse in 11. So this tells us what's been going on in Jesus' ministry. So in verse 35 we have Kai peri agen ha Jesus. This is from peri ago. It's an imperfect. The ministry is underway, so you give it an ongoing sort of translation. And Jesus kept on going around the cities, all of them, and the villages, didaskon, teaching in their synagogues and preaching the good news of the reign and healing every disease and every, literally, softness or weakness, referring to physical illness. Grammatically, you want to ask the question, what are these participles doing? We've got didaskon and keirison and therapeuon. The easiest thing probably is to just attach them closely to the main verb. This is what grammars sometimes call a supplementary participle, and that works tolerably well. You can argue that they might express purpose, and you actually do have a purpose construction in 11:1 in the third summary statement, so there'd be some evidence for that. But if we just kind of take them with the verb, and Jesus kept on going around teaching, so it's kind of a composite verbal idea. And notice that the message is the proclamation of the reign. That is the reign of God. And, of course, that's always an opportunity to stop and actually declare what the quote-unquote kingdom is. It's not a place, but it's rather the promised royal inbreaking of God into the world. And their message is that that started. And it started because Jesus is on the scene. So, and it's still going on because Jesus is still on the scene, right? And of course it's eschatological, and don't get me started, so we'll just keep going. Verse 36. Now we get into the parallels with Exodus 19. Idon is the participle from harao, the aorist participle. Seeing the crowds, he has to be Jesus. Es blank niste. Now this is a great verb because it's fun to say, especially if you have a slight cold and have a little bit of mucus going on. Splachnizomai is excellent fun. It means to show compassion, its deponent. He had compassion concerning them. Why? Because they were, and now we have two perfect participles passive. The first one is from skulo, which means to whip or to flay. And the second one is from ripto, which means to throw. And they're passive. And so because they had been whipped and thrown. This thought occurred to me, you know, it's not that Matthew is excusing the sin of the people. I mean, part of the problem is that they're whipped and flayed by their own sins. But when you think of sinners as people who are sort of helplessly tossed about and attacked, then I think you have a better shot at compassion, you know, as opposed to just thinking about sinners as bad people that should know better. It's not like that one or the other is true, but I just, that thought just occurred to me that the participles are passive. These things are being done to them. They have been whipped and they have been tossed. And that's probably a good good thing for us to remember. They are hose probata, like sheep who do not have a shepherd. And since that's the way they are, and that's the way Jesus perceives them, verse 37, that he says to his disciples, now we have a mende, which we recognize. On the one hand, the therismos, the harvest is great. There is a kind of an end time tinge to this term. It occurs in Matthew in the parable of the wheat and the tares, for instance, wait until the harvest. So the harvesting activity has already started. Or I should say the working in the harvest fields, not the harvesting itself. On the one hand, the harvest is big, polis, much. On the other hand, the workers are few. Then we have verse 38. This is from deomai, which means to ask or beseech. So it'd be, this would actually be aorist imperative, passive, deponent, second person plural. Therefore, beseech, and you beseech someone in the genitive, beseech the Lord of the harvest. Hupos here after deomai is like a hutti clause. It's not purpose. It's giving the content of the beseeching. So beseech the Lord of the harvest that he throw out, literally, workers into his harvest. Kind of like call day, I guess. Or the day after commencement or something. Don't we kick them out of the housing right away, don't we, Reed? Or we should, yeah. No, just kidding. And then Jesus answers the prayer in the next verse. Right? It's very abrupt. So you could actually, you know, stop here. It'd be enough to preach on. Again, the compassion of Jesus, which leaks over, if you will, into his disciples who are to pray that God will send workers. It seems like an odd idea. Don't you think that the Almighty could take care of this on his own? No. He seems to like to pick people like Moses, the elders of Israel, the 12, in order to accomplish what he wants done. So it's always been this way. He put Adam and Eve in charge of the garden, right? So verse 10. And summoning the 12 disciples of him. Now this is the first reference in Matthew to the 12. So I think we should envision a larger group of mathetai. And from that larger group, Jesus picks 12. Okay. Now that brings up actually an important point for application. That is, in one sense, this chapter 10 describes a unique ministry. That you can't just willy-nilly say, okay, go out and be like the 12. The proof of this, by the way, is found in verse 8 of chapter 10. And that's the part that clumsy application often overlooks. So if we're going to be just like the 12, then we've got to heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons, etc. Yeah, and Ben is saying, okay, let's go. Okay, good. Have a nice day, Ben. But just because this is a unique ministry of the 12 doesn't mean there's not application. And the way to do it is, I think, found in Exodus 19. That is, the nation as a whole is a priesthood. The nation as a whole is a holy nation or a nation set apart, right? And that works pretty slick in Matthew because there are 12 of these people. They are the 12 tribes of the new Israel. Okay? And so the apostles were uniquely sent. And we're not sent in the same way as the apostles are. But the church, as the new Israel, is sent. And then it's not hard at all to be a Lutheran here. That is, in my vocation, then I am sent to participate, contribute to, support, you know, the compassionate outreach of the Good Shepherd. So please try to avoid, make them feel guilty because they're not Oswald Hoffman's school of evangelism motivation. I mean, I grew up feeling guilty because I wasn't Ozzy Hoffman. Are you guys old enough to know who Ozzy Hoffman was? Oh man, Reed, we got to retire, man. Shoot me. Oswald Hoffman was, I think he was like the third Lutheran Hour speaker, actually, wasn't he? But he was this voice on the radio that you grew up with. And everybody was always being exhorted to witness like Ozzy Hoffman can witness. Well, you know what? Nobody could witness like Ozzy Hoffman except Ozzy Hoffman. It's like being told to preach like Reed Lessing. I mean, you just feel inferior all the time. So, you know, just give thanks for the gifts and just do it, you know. So don't be Ozzy Hoffman, be a plumber, you know, or a wife or a kid or a pastor in at the Wrath of God Lutheran Church in Nowhere, Nebraska or whatever. I think we'll send Eric to Nowhere, Nebraska. That'll be good. So.
Well, maybe it's his name, Wrath of God.
Okay, well, you can get him to change the name. Okay, so that's kind of the basic theology of this thing. So let's read some more Greek. Verse 10. And summoning the 12 disciples of him, Edoken looks like a... You see a kappa, you go, oh, a perfect. No, it's the aorist of Didomi. He gave to them authority, literally, of unclean spirits. So that'd probably be an objective genitive, to have authority over. Now, hosta plus the infinitive normally expresses result, with the result that they cast out and heal every disease and every infirmity. Again, this shows the uniqueness of the sending of the 12. And now we have them by name. Verse 2. Notice the emphasis here. I mean, twice Matthew takes 12 and puts it in the front of the clause. He really is actually emphasizing that this is a kind of a unique crowd here. So, of the 12 apostles' names, literally, right? Names is the subject of estim. But you front the modifier, it's really emphasizing that this is the 12, right? By the way, this is the only time that the term apostle occurs in Matthew. This is the only time. So the names of the 12 apostles are these. First, Simon, the one who is called Peter, and Andrew, the brother of him, and James, the one of Zebedee, and John, the brother of him. Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax gatherer, or tax farmer, James, the one of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, Simon, the Canaanean, probably a term that means zealot from the Aramaic, you can look that up, and Judas, the Iscariot one. According to Raymond Brown, the great Catholic exegete, nobody knows what Iscariot means. There's about 5 different guesses, and no one's been able to win the day. So, save that one for the eschaton. But Judas is further modified with an arthrous participle, ha kai paradus auton. This is from paradidomi, and it means to hand over, either in a positive or negative sense. Here, obviously, in a negative sense, the one who betrayed him. So there's kind of a grim note, you know, even at the very beginning of this powerful sending text. So again, it's the 12. See, by the way, another way to make a connection with the 12 would be, you might not go necessarily to Ephesians, but built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets. See, we're, as a church, sent to bear their message, right? And it's because they were chosen, these sinners were chosen and empowered very specifically by Jesus, that the church has anything to say, you know, whatsoever. So again, you don't want to moosh the sendings together, because then you end up saying silly things and ignoring Bible verses, which is a bad idea. Verse 5. Here we have again, these 12. emphatic, right? It's the direct object. It's not supposed to be in the front. But Matthew is emphasizing that. These 12, Jesus apostelend, from apostello, liquid stem verb, so you get the different changes in the stem, aorist indicative. Jesus sent, parangelos is from parangelo, means to charge or command, and maybe expressing manner by charging them in the dative, saying, into the way of Gentiles, me ap eltheta. This is from ap erkomai. It's the aorist subjunctive, active, second plural, and it's a prohibition. Don't depart into the way of Gentiles, and into a city of Samaritans, now me plus another aorist subjunctive, do not enter. Again, this shows you again the specificity of what's going on here. I mean, this can't possibly apply to us in any sort of helpful way, right? Don't go to the Italians, you know. Don't go to the, you know. And people have tried to spiritualize. Don't try to spiritualize it. Root it in history, right? And then, from that, go on to make a valid application, which is not that hard to do. Verse 6, poriuesta. This could be an indicative, but it's an imperative in context, from poruomai, deponent. Journey, or go, rather, prosta pravita, to the sheep, the apololata. This is from the verb from Gehenna, apolimi, which means to destroy, be lost. That's what this verb is. It's actually a perfect participle. You only know that by pointing and clicking. The sheep, the lost ones, which are the house of Israel. It's not that some sheep in Israel are lost, but most are okay. The whole lot of them are like sheep who have been flayed and thrown. Right? So they call this an exegetical genitive. And I'm happy to have been able to say that. So the lost sheep, which are the house of Israel. And as you go, kerusita, preach and say that, here it is again, the reign of heaven has come near. God has broken into history. And see, we can say the same thing, because where Jesus is, there God is breaking into history. And Lutherans, of all people, know where Jesus is, right? So every time you baptize, every time you preach, every time you absolve, every time the sacrament is administered, every time the love of Christ has been received and then is given, guess what? The reign of heaven is breaking into history every single time. So, and it's come near. And now we have the specific commission, verse 8. The first word is a participle from asthenao, and we should take it as a substantive, those who are weak, and it's accusative plural, so it's the object of the verb. Those who are being weak or sick, heal, therapeuta. Necrous people, necrotic people, dead people, raise. Leprous people, cleanse. Demons, ekbalata, cast out. These are all present imperatives. It's pretty emphatic. I mean, it's really very emphasis oriented here, and you can maybe put them all in italics or something, you know, to get the job done. And then the verse ends with this little kind of an aphorism. Doraon can mean to no effect. It literally means freely, and it can have either a positive or a negative sense. Here it's positive. So you received freely, data, give freely. And so again, the application of the text, the theology is the compassion of Jesus by which he calls a people to himself and then sends them out to extend that compassion. By the way, it's interesting, historically, the things that he gave the disciples to do are the very things that he's been doing. So again, that really shows a kind of a unique historical connection between the 12 and Jesus. So they are, in this text, in a very important way, the unrepeatable apostles. But again, we stand on their shoulders, right? And flip to the end of the gospel, which we just read for Holy Trinity Sunday a couple of weeks ago. And now the mission is no longer limited to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, but it's go and make disciples of Pantatayate, all the nations. Right? So a sermon like this is a good opportunity to kind of do a little theology and enable people to think. It's almost a little mini hermeneutics lesson on how to take a text and apply it in a valid way. So it's kind of a neat opportunity in that sense. But again, it's strongly filled with the compassion of Christ. The last little aphorism is really quite important. Reed, how did you say it? About identity and mission. How did you articulate it again? If you don't know your identity, you won't do mission or something like that. Yeah. And so really the pastor's job, his primary job, that he has to take care of first of all, is to fill the people with their identity, you know, and to proclaim to them what they've received. And then having received that, to invite them and to lead them into giving freely what in fact they have freely received. So, and then there, again, you could read farther, but I think the hermeneutics of the rest of this first half of chapter 10 actually are more difficult. And so it's probably a wise move to stop at verse 8 and just preach on that. So, good, we got about a minute left. Any questions? Grammar, hermeneutics, anything?
You said spiritualized. Is that like the scene is being allegorized?
Yeah. People will sometimes, spiritualize / allegorize. So, for instance, I've heard them allegorize, don't go to the way of the Gentiles. This means don't go to people who are really hostile. Well, wait, everybody by nature is really hostile. See? So, yeah, it's that kind of an invalid, you could call it an allegorizing, right? So. Good. All right. Very fine. Thank you very much.